The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, one of tonight's stories includes a graphic dissection of an animal. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator, and tonight's episode welcomes a new author to the show, Dana Norris. Dana has provided us with two stories this evening, both involving the trials and tribulations that we all go through while growing up. Well, maybe not the exact same trials and tribulations, but you get the idea. First, we have 1999, where our narrator tells us of how he met a new and rather odd friend one summer when he was 11. Then, in Trust, we meet Ethan, a newly graduated teen about to go camping with some friends before college. Right before leaving, his father entrusts him with a handgun in case of an emergency, and, as expected, that handgun plays a pivotal role in the events that follow. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Dana Norris, I give you 1999. It was the summer of 1999. I was spending my afternoon down by the creek behind the Hinesome farm, throwing stones into the water. My friend Matt moved away at the end of the school year. Otherwise, he'd have been with me, probably doing something more exciting than just throwing stones. Although he only moved an hour or so away, it might as well be across the country when I relied on my parents to drive me everywhere. I was turning 12 next month and hoped that he could come out for my birthday, or possibly even sleep over. I was lost in my thoughts, watching the stones disappear through the water's murky surface, when I heard a boy's voice. "Hey, you're gonna scare all the fish away!" I turned to see a boy I didn't recognize standing a few yards away from me, holding a makeshift fishing pole. He had fashioned it out of a long tree branch with a string tied to the end. "There's no fish in here, nothing worth catching anyway," I replied, trying to appear knowledgeable about the subject. The boy shrugged casually, his hand-me-down shirt and faded jean shorts hanging loosely on his body. "Fishing's more for contemplating. That's what my dad says, anyway," he replied. "Do you want to hunt some crawdads with me?" "Crawdads?" I repeated. "Those little lobster guys that live in creeks like this. I bet there's a ton of them here." "Oh, I call them crayfish," I said. "Same thing. Some people call them prawns or river shrimp. It's just words. Whatever you call them, they're still fun to catch." I liked him instantly. His name was Zachary, but he preferred Zach. We spent a few hours picking up rocks and watching the crayfish skitter about in the shallow water. He was skilled at catching them without getting pinched. I was admittedly rusty with that part. He told me he and his parents moved into the old house a few miles down the road from where I lived. His father was working on fixing the house up, as nobody had lived there for some time. After we scared all the crayfish away, I invited him to come back to my house for dinner. He thanked me, but declined. He had to get home to help his mother. I found it a little odd, because in my 12 years, I'd rarely given any thought to helping my mother with anything more than killing the occasional spider that found its way into the house. We decided to meet at the creek again the next day.
"Well, I think that's very sweet of him,"
my mother, Susan, stated that evening at the dinner table. I just finished telling her and my father about my new friend. "I wouldn't mind if you helped me with the dishes tonight, Adam." I rolled my eyes and groaned, but my dad gave me a look that said, "Wash and dry." "Where did you say they lived again?" my dad spoke after a bite of his mashed potatoes. "Zach said they moved into the old house up on Walker Street." I shrugged. "I thought that place was in pretty sad shape. Can't imagine anyone living there without a lot of work being done first." My dad continued, shoveling another helping of mashed potatoes into his mouth. "His dad is rebuilding it," I said, growing defensive. I didn't care about the house Zach lived in, but my dad wouldn't let it go. "We should take a quick drive up there after dinner to check it out. Maybe he could use some extra hands," he went on.
"Paul, leave them alone. You don't have to go sticking your nose in everybody's business,"
Susan scolded lightly. He shrugged in response and washed his mashed potatoes down with a swig of Sam Adams. I was just about finished with the dishes when my dad clapped his hand on my shoulder, startling me. "Come on, let's go check it out. You can introduce me to your new buddy." We got into my dad's old Chevy and rumbled down the road. When I saw the house, my heart sank a little. It had been some time since I saw it last. I didn't realize how bad it had gotten. The house seemed to have collapsed into itself. The front door hung crookedly from one hinge, and most of the windows were broken. There were no cars or construction equipment in the driveway or yard.
"Huh," Dad grunted. He pulled into the driveway to turn around. "Doesn't look like anyone's been here for a while, kiddo. You sure this is the house he was talking about?"
I didn't know what to say. I don't know why my dad cared so much. As we pulled out of the driveway, I thought I saw movement through one of the broken windows. Then again, it was probably a raccoon or something. The next day, it rained so hard that I could barely see the trees lining our property. I thought about my plans to meet with Zach at the creek. I would be drenched before I got 10 feet from my house. I stared out the window for a long time, contemplating if I should still go, in case Zach was out there waiting for me. I grabbed my raincoat and boots out of the hall closet.
"Where do you think you're going?"
My mom's voice came from behind me as I slipped into the boots. I turned around. "I was supposed to meet with Zach today by the creek," I said simply. My mom pursed her lips.
"I don't think that's a great idea, honey. He's probably staying home today. Staying dry, you can hang out with him another day."
I protested, but she held firm. I wasn't going outside after all. I paced the house tirelessly, hoping for the rain to let up. It was still drizzling the following day, but not enough to keep me cooped up. The air outside was humid, but smelled clean and pure. I trudged across the soggy lawn, wondering if Zach would be at the creek that day. The creek was flooded, with debris collected along the banks. I looked around for Zach, but he wasn't there. I turned back to head home when I heard the splash bloop of a large rock hitting the water. I wheeled around to see Zach standing on the opposite bank. He grinned at me and waved for me to follow him down the stream. I kept pace with him on my side of the creek, and he took me to a section where some logs and branches had formed a dam.
"You can cross over here,"
Zach called above the noise of the rushing water. It was much deeper here than upstream. The current made dark swells on either side of the makeshift bridge. Zach saw me eyeballing the water.
"Come on, don't be a pussy. You can do it. I did it, no problem."
He beckoned with his arms. I had heard that word a few times, but each time it still struck me a little. I took a tentative step onto the closest log. It wiggled a little, but seemed sturdy enough otherwise. I looked up at Zach, whose eyes were fixed on me. Another step, reaching out to balance myself on a branch that protruded upwards. I kept moving forward until I reached midway and realized none of the branches ahead of me looked strong enough to support my weight.
"You have to crawl. Spread your weight out more,"
Zach encouraged me.
I continued, not wanting to seem like a chicken. The first step I took made the branch sag a few inches into the water. I held on to whatever sticks and twigs I could to stay upright as the water pulled at my submerged foot. As I lifted my right foot to continue, the branch snapped and my left foot plunged into the water up to my thigh. I grabbed for the smaller branches, but they didn't help. I kicked out, trying to find a rock or the bottom of the stream, to no avail. I was falling backwards into the water, and I was pulling the branches down on top of me. The water was cold from the rain, catching my breath in my chest as I went under. The current swept me further as I struggled to get back to the surface. Finally, I was able to get my head above water, and I saw Zach watching me with a strange look on his face. "Help me!" I cried out, still being dragged down by the current. This seemed to snap Zach out of that trance-like state he was in. He ran down the side of the stream until he was past me and plunged in. He swam out to me as I came by and grabbed my arm. The two of us eventually made it back to the bank, gasping for air. I was shaking badly, either from the cold water or adrenaline, or both. I looked over at Zach, expecting the same, but he seemed unfazed by the cold. "That was exciting," he said, eyes gleaming. I stared at him in disbelief. "Are you kidding me? My mom's gonna kill me," I spat. "I could have drowned, no thanks to you." "No thanks to me? I just saved your ass," Zach came back. "Only an idiot tries to swim against the current. I thought you would have known that, spending so much time here." I felt my cheeks burn and was thankful for the little heat that my anger provided me. "I should never have listened to you," I said bitterly. "If you hadn't, you'd never know what it's like to really live." Zach's eyes were wild. "You sound like a psycho. I don't have to almost drown to appreciate breathing," I snapped at him. Zach's face grew dark. "Don't call me that." He looked different. He looked almost menacing, with his chest heaving, dark hair matted down on his head. "Whatever, man," I said, trying to de-escalate the situation. "But you did it," he exclaimed brightly. "See, you're on the other side now." He waved his hands. I looked around. We were much farther downstream than I expected. I didn't want to even think about trying to cross the stream again. I would have to walk all the way down past the farm to where there was a small one-lane bridge for cars. And from there, it was at least an hour more to get home. I told Zach I had to go home to change out of my drenched clothes. He complained a little bit, but eventually let me go in peace. I invited him to come with me, but he declined, saying he should go home to change clothes as well. I was partly relieved when he said no. I wasn't too eager to spend much more time with him that day, but I knew my mother would take it easier on me if I had a friend there. During the long walk home, I kept feeling like someone was watching me. I had seen Zach walk off in the opposite direction, but I couldn't help but get the idea out of my head that he was following me, watching me. Fortunately for me, my mother was out grocery shopping when I got home. The dry erase board had, "Zucchini lasagna tonight, be home in a few hours," scrawled on it in my mother's handwriting. I grimaced at the idea of zucchini replacing pasta. As I changed my clothes, I heard a noise outside. I went to my window to investigate. It was Zach, standing in my backyard. He was still wearing the same clothes, but they looked dry somehow. He was holding something that looked like a dirty gray rag and beckoning for me to come outside. When I got to the door, something didn't feel right. Call it a gut feeling. I looked at that rag in his hand again, and my stomach sank. It was a cat. "Look what I found," he called out, holding it up. "It was stuck in some branches along the stream where we were." I made a face. "Why would you bring it here?" I asked. Zach shrugged. "You followed me home with a dead cat," I pushed. "Well, yeah," he said, uncertain. "I thought it was cool. We can play mad scientist and inspect it and stuff." He had me there. That did sound kind of cool. It wasn't too far off from when I used to do frog experiments with Matt by the stream. We would catch a frog and knock it on the head with a stick. Then we would time how long they would take to wake up and write it in our notebook. Some of the frogs never woke up, of course, but it was in the name of science. Besides, it's not like Zach killed the cat. It was already dead. We went to the shed where my father kept his tools. An hour later, Zach disappeared into the woods, saying he had to get home to help his mother again. Coincidentally, my mom pulled into the driveway minutes after he disappeared into the woods. I helped my mom carry the grocery bags inside, thinking about the cat and what Zach had told me. My mom was talking about this new recipe she would try for dinner tomorrow night, and listening to her talk about mixing the ground beef with ground sausage made me nauseous. I didn't eat much of her zucchini lasagna that night. After dinner, I went to bed early, much to the surprise of my parents. "Are you feeling okay, sweetie?" my mom said, pressing the back of her hand against my forehead. I brushed her hand away and said I was just tired. This made her exchange a look with my dad, who said nothing. I lay in my bed that night, thinking about Zach and that cat. At first, I was excited to study the drowned cat's body with him. We found a plank of scrap wood to secure it to, an autopsy table, Zach called it. We used wire to stretch the arms and legs out, belly up. Then Zach came out of the shed with a hacksaw. "This is what vets use to tell if an animal has rabies," he said, holding the saw out for me to see. "We have to make sure it's safe before we do anything else." I wasn't sure if he was just making stuff up at this point for the game, or if he was serious. I watched until he pressed the saw blade against the cat's neck. I looked away from the cat and focused on him. I heard everything as he set to work. His strokes were slow and deliberate. So, I started. It took a few seconds to steady my voice. "My dad and I went to go see your house last night." Zach stopped and looked up at me. "And we didn't see any cars or construction stuff," I said tentatively. Zach shrugged and continued to saw at the cat's neck. I got a little queasy when I heard the saw hit wood. "He packs everything up inside at night so nobody steals it. Do you have a plastic bag?" Zach's answer and complete change in direction caught me off guard. I nodded and ran to grab a bag from the kitchen. Through the kitchen window, I watched as Zach wiped the hacksaw off on a rag and put it back on the shelf. When I returned with the bag, he had an X-Acto knife in his hand. Zach put the blade to the top of the cat's throat and made a long incision down the center. "My mom's trying to leave my dad," he said quietly as he worked, pulling the skin away from the flesh beneath. "She wants to take me with her." Another incision down the inside of the back leg. "This makes my dad real angry," he continued, cutting a ring around the bases of the hind feet. I watched, silently, horrified, as he repeated this process with the front paws. Zach went on. "They got into a big argument one night." He glanced at me for a moment, over the half-flayed cat. Zach's face was calm, but his eyes burned. "It doesn't help that he drinks so much." He returned his attention to the cat, pulling gently on the skin. "They think I'm asleep, but I'm listening from the stairs. I can hear him calling me names, saying I'm crazy. My mom knows I'm not. She defends me. I hear her cry out when he hits her." I grabbed my baseball bat. He continued. As I listened to what Zach was saying, I realized he was telling me about something that had already happened. It was like when people on TV get hypnotized and talk about memories like they're reliving them. "I can hear them both screaming at each other as I creep down the stairs. He wants to take me to some doctor, but my mom says that he's the one who needs the doctor," Zach went on. Her screams cut off right as I get to the kitchen doorway. He had untied the cat's hind legs and was pulling the skin off like a sweater. "This part's much easier when the body's warm," he explained casually, as if he wasn't in the middle of telling me an extremely disturbing story, as if he had done this many, many times to animals that weren't already dead when he found them. "What happened to your mother?" I asked, dreading his answer. Zach said nothing. He refastened the cat's hind legs to the board and made another long incision down the center of the belly. "You have to be careful here. Too deep and you can cut open the stomach or guts, and then you have a mess on your hands." I grimaced as he stuck his hand inside and pulled out the cat's organs. The smell was awful. I tried to keep from gagging as he pointed out the heart, the stomach, the bladder, the kidneys. "Aha!" Zach smiled at me and held something up. "The lungs." He gave them a gentle shake. He cut one open, and some foul-smelling water dribbled out.
"Case closed. I can now confirm that the victim has indeed died of drowning, officer,"
he said in a deep, cartoonish voice. I thought I was going to be sick. "Let's get a body bag for this thing and put it to rest," he said, still ignoring my question. We got a hefty bag and dumped the cat and its entrails into it, board and all. We wiped off the knife and put it back on my dad's workbench, got a shovel, and set out into the woods. Neither of us spoke until after we piled a few rocks on top of the grave.
"Zach," I started timidly, "what happened to your mom?"
I repeated my question from earlier. He stared straight ahead and wiped his nose on his hand.
"I wasn't fast enough."
He lifted his shirt slightly, and I saw he had a deep gash in his side. I gasped.
"Oh my God, dude, is that from last night? How are you not—"
And then, part of me understood. Zach cocked his head and looked at the sky, which was getting dark.
"I gotta get home to help my mom. See you around."
And with that, he left. He walked back into the woods, and I never saw him again. I didn't have to search around on the internet for long to discover the full story. I saw a picture of Zach and his parents. Double homicide, followed by a suicide in that old house on Walker Street. It happened when I was in kindergarten. To this day, the rational part of my brain tries to convince me that none of this ever happened. That I had probably seen that picture on the news when it happened. Then, in the summer of 1999, my brain made everything up out of boredom because my friend had moved away. It almost sounds plausible, but I know for a fact that if I go digging around in the woods behind my dad's shed, I will find those cat bones.
You've been listening to 1999 by Dana Norris. Next, here's Trust, also from Dana Norris.
It was a rainy week, which didn't bother Ethan. He was happy for a reprieve from the relentless heat and humidity that came with August in the south. As the last days of summer dwindled, he was determined to have one last hurrah with his friends before they scattered off to their chosen universities. The five of them had been inseparable since middle school, and this sudden and inevitable change left Ethan trying not to be envious of them for branching out into the world. He had decided to attend the local community college to save his parents some money. He was hoping the rain would let up at least a day or two before their big adventure. Ethan and his best friend Jacob had planned a camping trip one night after a few drags on a wrinkled joint.
"We should get some poles and tents and hike out to Blue Ridge Lake for a weekend. You, me, Sam, Aaron, Tommy,"
Jacob said excitedly between coughs. Ethan liked the idea immediately. It was low budget. Most of the supplies they would need could be scavenged from their parents' garages. It also allowed them to spend quality time together before going their separate ways the following week. Ethan knew that quality time was a term to be laughed at by the rest of his buddies, so he didn't say those exact words out loud when suggesting the idea to them. The sky was still cloudy the day they were packing up the supplies, but the sun was peeking through reassuringly. Ethan's father called him inside to speak with him in private.
"You boys be careful this weekend," he began in a serious tone. "Blue Ridge Lake's a huge reservation, nothing but wilderness for miles."
Ethan braced himself, knowing his father was about to give him the typical "be safe, make right choices" speech. But when his father produced a small black case from under the kitchen table and handed it to him, a slight chill ran down his back. His father was giving him his handgun.
"This is for emergencies only. There are a lot of wild animals out there that have learned a campsite can be an easy meal ticket."
His father held on to the case and looked Ethan in the eye for a moment before releasing his grip.
"Don't tell your friends you even have it with you. They'll want to see it. I trust you to be responsible with it, but I can't say the same for your friends, especially Sam. Keep it locked up and hidden at all times."
"I will," Ethan promised solemnly. His father smiled and clapped him on the back.
"I'm sure you won't even need it, but it's always better to be prepared in case you do. Have fun this weekend, kiddo."
Once the gear was loaded into Jacob's truck, the boys waved goodbye to Ethan's parents and took off down the road. On the highway, the suburban surroundings quickly gave way to a thick wall of towering pine trees. In this area, it didn't take long to transition from civilization to complete and utter wilderness. Ethan always liked that about where he lived. Years ago, his father would take him on fishing trips, and he would pretend they were hunter-gatherers in ancient times. It felt like they were in an alternate reality where there were no cars and large cities, only the sounds and smells of the forest and its inhabitants. The boys took their exit and said goodbye to the highway, modern plumbing, and decent cell phone signals. Ethan couldn't help but feel a little giddy as they finally pulled into the parking lot of the campground office. As often as he had gone camping with his father, this was the first time he and his friends went completely on their own. He and Jacob went into the office to check in. The walls of the office were filled with maps of the park and a few poorly executed taxidermied animals. One of them was a brown rabbit with antlers attached to its head behind the ears. The placard underneath read, "The Elusive Jackalope," which made Ethan smile.
"Hello, boys. What can I do you for?"
The elderly man behind the front desk smiled at them. He looked like a seasoned outdoorsman, with unkempt hair and a strong jawline grizzled with silver stubble. "Just checking in for the weekend," Jacob responded politely.
"Ah,"
the man said as he pulled out a massive binder. He set it on the desk and paged through it.
"Last name?"
"Connolly."
"I see. Well, boys, it looks like you're in luck. Rains didn't hit us too hard out here in the mountains, so it shouldn't be too muddy."
The man stared at the boys for a moment before adding,
"I'm sure you boys don't need me to remind you that alcoholic beverages, fireworks, and firearms are not permitted in the park."
Ethan immediately thought of his father's gun tucked away in his duffel bag.
"Of course not, sir," Jacob replied coolly. "We're just here to catch some fish and get some fresh air."
His answer seemed to satisfy the old man. Jacob signed his name in the binder, and the man handed him a folded map of the main trails.
"You can drive your car along this road here until you hit a fork. Go left. Follow that until you hit the parking area. Make sure you lock everything up before you continue down this trail."
He circled the trail with a red pen.
"After that, you can hike until you find a decent area to set up camp. Mind you, the closer you stay to the parking area, the more foot traffic you're going to get with other campers. Not that there are many campers left out there this late in the season. Everybody's heading back to work and school."
Ethan and Jacob thanked the man and made their way back to the truck, where Sam was having a smoke.
"All set?"
Sam asked, stamping a cigarette butt into the ground. They got back into the truck and headed down the dirt road to the parking area. There were only a handful of cars there. A couple unpacking their Subaru waved to the boys as they rolled by. Another family was packing their camping supplies back into their Escalade, preparing to head back into civilization. As the boys unloaded the truck, Ethan opened his duffel to store his phone in an inside pocket. The gun case poked out at the top briefly and caught Sam's eye before Ethan closed the bag up again.
"Hey, what's that?"
he asked. Ethan pretended not to hear his question and slung his bag over his shoulder.
"We should get a move on, guys. I don't feel like sleeping under the stars tonight."
Once they were all ready to go, the boys set out on the trail. They passed by two campsites that looked well-worn, but Sam insisted they go deeper into the woods for a better spot. After walking for about 30 minutes, they passed the couple who waved to them in the parking area. The two waved cheerfully again as they struggled to pitch their tent in the small clearing. They walked for almost 3 hours until the trail they followed looked as if nature had reclaimed it, if not for the occasional markings on the trees. Finally, they came to rest in a clearing and decided that was the spot. It was large enough to accommodate the two tents and had a small stone-lined fire pit. A narrow footpath would take them down to the lake. Aaron and Tommy, identical twins, immediately set to work on the family-sized tent they brought. Ethan and Jacob set up the smaller tent, while Sam took off down the footpath to gather firewood. One of the cords used to secure the rain cover was twisted into a horrible knot. Ethan tried to pick at it, unsuccessfully. Frustrated, he tossed the mangled mess aside. Tommy came over and pulled out his pocket knife.
"Want me to give it a try?"
Ethan shrugged in response.
"It's no use as is. Go for it."
Tommy cut one section of the cord with a deft flick of the blade. Within a few minutes, he was able to untangle the rest of the knot and handed the cord back to Ethan.
"Thanks, man. Good thinking."
He retied the two pieces and finished securing the cover. When Sam reappeared, conveniently after the tents had been constructed, he dumped a small armful of twigs and branches next to the fire pit.
"Good job on that firewood, Sam," Aaron called from the entrance of his tent. "That should last us a whole 20 minutes.
Sam was too busy to notice or care about Aaron's comment, dragging a giant Yeti cooler that his dad lent him for the weekend. He positioned it next to the fire pit and opened it to reveal a bottle of whiskey and a case of beer, along with their food provisions.
"I was getting a bit thirsty," he said with a smirk as he cracked open a can. "Anybody else?"
The rest of the boys eagerly joined him, but Ethan hesitated.
"We're not supposed to have any booze in the park," he began.
"We're all underage. What if somebody reports us?"
"Relax," Sam said dismissively, pushing back his dark hair. "We haven't seen anybody for hours."
Watching his friends slurp down their beers, Ethan shrugged and took one.
"Just make sure we pick up all the trash," he added before taking his first sip.
They gathered more wood after their beers and soon had a nice fire going. The twins took the two fishing poles and disappeared down the footpath to scout out good fishing spots. Sam, who had three beers and the time it took the rest of them to finish their first, decided it was time for a nap and retreated into the larger tent. Ethan and Jacob sat staring into the fire, enjoying the peace. As much as Ethan enjoyed being deep in the woods, he also found himself uneasy as he took in their surroundings. He looked around and thought about how easy it would be for an animal or person to watch them from a distance without ever being detected. The forest floor was covered with a thick layer of soft pine needles that absorbed the sounds of footsteps. That night, they had hot dogs for dinner as the twins returned empty-handed from their first fishing excursion. They did, however, find a baby deer and its dead mother down near the lake. They said it looked as if the deer had been shot, despite hunting season not starting for a few months. This brought the mood down significantly, and the boys fell silent, picturing the baby deer curled up against its dead mother, as the twins described. Aaron said they had tried to catch it, but it always ran off to hide in the nearby brush, unwilling to leave its mother. Sam joked that they were actually standing on an ancient Indian burial ground. They all laughed, too easily, relieved to have any excuse to switch subjects. Soon, they were passing the bottle of whiskey around and toasting to old friends and new beginnings. As the surrounding woods got darker, Ethan couldn't help but think about how remote their campsite was and how exposed he felt, sitting there with his back to the shadows of the tree line. He thought about the dead deer. He did his best to shake the feeling and enjoy his time with his buddies. The whiskey helped a bit. The next morning, he and Jacob took the poles and tried their luck. They managed a few decent-sized trout by the time their stomachs growled for lunch, and they took their spoils to share with the others. Ethan kept his eyes peeled for the dead deer or its baby, but saw no signs of them. Sam wasn't all too interested in fishing, though he didn't hesitate to help himself to the trout. He spent the rest of the day exploring the woods with the twins in hopes of finding a larger supply of firewood, since they had burned through their supply already. As the sun dipped below the tops of the trees, he emerged from the footpath.
"Jacob, Ethan, come check out this place that we found," Sam cried.
Jacob and Ethan obliged, stretching as they rose from their stump seats. He led them down the footpath towards the lake, but veered off as they neared the water.
"It's not far from here," he assured them.
After struggling through the overgrown foliage for another 20 minutes, they finally surfaced and saw Aaron and Tommy smiling and waving to them from atop a large boulder. It jutted out from the side of the mountain, making a platform that overlooked the valley and lake. Getting to the top was tough, but exciting, and the view once they made it was worth the sweat and scratches. Graffiti was scrawled on the rock wall that ran along the back of the boulder, and the surface was littered with cigarette butts and bits of trash.
"Isn't this great?" Sam exclaimed.
He stood near the front edge of the boulder and held his arms out to his sides.
"I feel like Simba on fucking Pride Rock!"
"It's a perfect smoke spot," Jacob admitted, already pulling out a small bag of pre-rolled joints from his pocket.
They lit two joints and passed them back and forth between the five of them. This was how Ethan pictured the camping trip. Not necessarily getting high, but all of them hanging out together, having a good time. Sam stood and brushed off the seat of his jeans.
I gotta take a piss, he grunted, before descending the side of the boulder and disappearing behind some trees. He was gone for a few minutes when Jacob spoke.
He's probably taking a huge dump. He could have just pissed off of the rock like this.
He stood and walked out to the front edge of the boulder and unzipped his pants. A pale yellow stream arched down from Jacob's body, disappearing into the trees below. It was almost picturesque, if it wasn't so vulgar.
You're welcome,
he called down to any plants and animals he might have just baptized, laughing as he zipped up.
Hey, what's the plan for dinner? Tommy spoke up. I'm getting some serious munchies.
Me too,
Aaron chimed in, chuckling to himself as if he had just told a hilarious joke.
What about Sam? Ethan asked. Jacob shrugged. I'm sure we'll run into him on the way back to camp.
As dusk set in, the boys made their way back down the side of the boulder one by one. Along the way back to camp, each boy gathered as many sticks as they could carry so they could cook up more hot dogs. It was already dark by the time they reached their site, so Jacob and the twins got to work starting a fire. Sam was there waiting for them. He told them he got thirsty and figured the rest of them would just come back to camp shortly after anyway. He chugged the rest of the beer he was holding and belched loudly before grabbing a second. He'll fit right in at college, Ethan thought to himself. Sam was the largest of them all and had already demonstrated typical frat boy qualities. They ate dinner in relative silence, too busy stuffing their mouths with reheated barbecue chicken that Aaron and Tommy's mother had packed for them. She also packed potatoes wrapped in tinfoil that they tossed into the hot embers to roast. Ethan decided he could never sustain himself on the hunter-gatherer diet he had once imagined during those camping trips with his father. You just can't beat barbecue chicken. He went into his tent to change into warmer clothing and immediately noticed his gun case was out and open. The gun was nowhere to be seen.
Who's been through my stuff?
Ethan snarled as he re-emerged from the tent flap. The other boys had moved on from dinner and were now roasting marshmallows. He was met with looks of confusion.
My gun is missing, he said when no one responded.
You brought a gun with you?
Sam asked, raising an eyebrow.
No one's touched your stuff, Ethan. Are you sure you didn't misplace it?
Jacob suggested.
I haven't touched it since we set up camp yesterday, and now the case is wide open and the gun's gone,
Ethan explained, sounding more panicked than he would like. He looked at Sam, who now seemed preoccupied with poking the fire with a stick.
Why did you bring a gun? Aaron asked.
Probably afraid of bears,
Tommy quipped. The twins laughed together and high-fived.
Sam, did you touch the gun?
Ethan asked pointedly. He was the only one who had the time to do it.
What? No!
Sam said back with matched intensity.
I didn't even know you had one with you.
You saw it in the parking area. You asked me about it, Ethan said.
Dude, I just thought it was a weird tackle box or something. I swear I didn't touch your gun.
Sam held his free hand up in a mock Scout's Honor motion.
Where is it then?
Ethan's heart was pounding in his chest. His dad would murder him if he lost his gun.
It's not in my tent anywhere.
We'll look for it in the morning when it's light out. It's probably just covered with some clothing. Jacob tried to reassure him.
Come on, have a marshmallow. Grab a beer. We'll find it tomorrow when we pack everything back up. Ethan wasn't entirely comfortable with the whereabouts of the gun being unknown, but he took a marshmallow anyway and speared it on the end of a stick to roast over the fire. He couldn't stop watching Sam, who seemed to avoid his gaze. After a long, uncomfortable silence, Tommy spoke.
We should tell a ghost story or something, all part of the camping experience.
He was trying to alleviate the tension.
I've got one, Sam said, staring into the flames. It's about a bunch of friends from high school. It was the summer before they all left for college. They all got accepted into different schools, far away from each other.
He looked around at his friends.
All of them, except one.
Sam looked directly at Ethan when he said this.
This one guy soon grew jealous of his friends, so jealous, in fact, that he decided he didn't want them to leave him behind. He planned a trip for them all to go out deep into the woods.
Oh, fuck you, Sam, Ethan swore.
Come on, Sam, knock it off,
Jacob started, but Sam continued over him. He pulled out a cigarette and lit it.
This friend brought a gun with him with exactly 5 bullets, he said, with smoke trailing from his mouth.
He knew what he had to do so that they could never leave him. One night, when they were all asleep, he took his gun and pointed it directly at his sleeping friend's face. Bam! Sam yelled. The other friends heard the first shot and came running out of their tent to see what happened. He picked them off as they approached his tent. Bam, bam, bam! He paused for added effect. Then, with his last bullet, he points the gun at his own head and... Somewhere in the woods, a branch snapped and Sam fell silent. The boys listened for more sounds, but none came.
Okay, then, Aaron said quietly. He took a swig of whiskey and passed it to Tommy, who did the same. He offered the bottle to Ethan, who shook his head. Sam reached past him to take the bottle. At that moment, a man's voice boomed out from the darkness.
Put that bottle down, son.
The bottle slipped from Sam's hand and shattered at Ethan's boots. The boys jumped to their feet, trying to hide their empty beer cans from view.
Y'all sit down now,
the man said aggressively. Ethan's blood turned to ice when he heard a shotgun being cocked. A man appeared at the edge of the clearing. As he came closer to the fire, Ethan could see that the man was holding the shotgun and was followed by two other men. They all dressed the same, wearing dark green coveralls with boots and wide-brimmed hats. They also had thick utility belts with flashlights, ropes, and a knife. Ethan guessed they were park rangers. The one holding the shotgun was taller than the other two and reminded Ethan of one of the football coaches from his high school.
What do we have here?
The man spoke again.
You boys know that alcohol isn't permitted here on park grounds.
Sorry, sir, we didn't know,
Tommy blurted out, rising from his seat. The man swung around and pointed the shotgun at Tommy's chest.
I said sit down, he hollered.
Tommy sat, quieted.
I think these boys knew,
the second man said. His scraggly red beard clung to his face in patches.
I'd say they're nothing but a bunch of little liars.
The third man let out a harsh laugh, then spat dark tobacco juice on the ground. The first man kept his gun aimed at Tommy's chest.
Now I want all of you to put your hands behind your head and stand up. Slowly,
the man said. Ethan and his friends glanced around at each other before following the man's orders.
Turn around.
The boys slowly turned their backs to the men, uncertain of what would happen next. Ethan made eye contact with Jacob. His forehead was slick with sweat.
Ass forward,
barked the second man, whose voice sounded much closer than before. Ethan heard Jacob grunt in surprise as the man's hands roughly patted him down. When he pulled out the baggie of pre-rolled joints, he cried out in delight.
Aha! What do we have here?
He stuffed the bag into his pocket and made his way over to Ethan. Ethan was starting to understand these men were not rangers, and that realization put a knot in his gut. The smell of alcohol came off the man in waves as he groped Ethan's body. Under the watchful eye of the man with the shotgun, the third man had started the pat-down procedure at the other end of the line. Aaron was saying something that Ethan couldn't make out, but it resulted in a slap to the back of his head. Aaron stood quietly after that. On Tommy, they quickly found his small pocket knife and confiscated it, which brought the missing gun to Ethan's mind.
All clear, boss.
The second man spoke as he finished frisking Sam. He towed the broken bottle of whiskey at Sam's feet.
What a pity, he mumbled.
Next order of business,
the boss announced, walking around to face the boys.
We're gonna find out who this belongs to.
He reached behind his back and pulled out a 9mm handgun, Ethan's father's gun. Sam's head immediately whipped around to face Ethan, who could only open his mouth, speechless. The boss laughed.
I guess that was pretty easy then. Is this your gun, boy?
He held the gun out for Ethan to see. Nervously, Ethan nodded. These men must have been through their campsite while they were out on the rock. He was even more shocked when the man slapped the gun into his hand.
Come with me.
The boss placed a meaty hand on the back of Ethan's neck and steered him so he was standing a few feet from the rest of his friends. One man shoved Sam to fill the gap that Ethan left in the lineup.
These two,
the boss said, walking around the twins.
Pick one.
Ethan looked at the man blankly, then at Aaron and Tommy.
I don't know, Ethan started.
I said pick one!
The man roared, making them all jump.
Tommy!
Ethan blurted out, not knowing what he had just done.
And which one of you might be Tommy?
The boss was standing behind them now, his head jutting between theirs. The sudden transition in the man's voice, from fury to soothing calm, was unsettling. Tommy shakily raised his hand from behind his head.
Nice to meet you, Tommy,
the man said coldly. He stepped back, raised his shotgun, and aimed at the back of Tommy's head. Ethan and the other boys screamed as they watched Tommy's head explode into a shower of blood and brain matter. Ethan would never forget the sound or sight. Aaron fell to the ground with his brother, screaming wildly. He made a move to tackle the boss, but was met with a swift kick to the face. He slumped next to his dead brother, subdued. Jacob moved to come to his aid, but stopped when the smaller, boozy-smelling man pulled a large hunting knife and poked, almost delicately, at his chest with it. Sam made no move, just stared in silent horror at what remained of Tommy's head. Mark held out his hand to silence his wife, Julie, but she had stopped talking to listen to the sound of pained screams coming through the trees. They sent chills down her spine. The two sat for a moment, bristling with alarm as the screaming abruptly ended.
That was a gunshot, wasn't it? Do you think they're hurt?
She asked him anxiously, getting to her feet.
I don't know,
he answered.
Fireworks?
She suggested hopefully.
Maybe it was one of those mortar things.
He shook his head.
No, those have two booms, one to launch and one when it explodes.
They listened for anything else that could imply fireworks, but the woods around them were now eerily silent. Mark spoke first.
We'd better head over to see if everyone's okay.
He went to the tent and returned with a pair of flashlights.
Mark, wait. If it was a gunshot, shouldn't we go to the park office to get help?
Julie said. He paused and thought about it.
Maybe. I really don't know. It sounded like someone was hurt badly, but you're right. It could be dangerous.
He ran his fingers through his hair, frustrated.
You go back to the office and call the police. I have to go see if they need help. Immediate help.
Julie grabbed his arm.
No, Mark. We're not splitting up in the woods at night after hearing a possible gunshot. You're not at work right now. You don't have to rush off to save someone.
But, he protested.
No,
she cut him off.
It's at least a 20-minute hike back to the office. Who knows how far away those people are?
Mark knew she was right. The way those screams echoed through the woods made it clear they were coming from quite a distance.
We need to hurry then,
Mark finally answered. The two took off at a run. Ethan's hands were sweating as he raised his gun and pointed it at the boss. Tears threatened to blind him until they streamed down the sides of his face.
Do it, Ethan!
Jacob yelled.
Kill these motherfuckers!
The other two men were crouching behind Sam and Jacob, using their bodies as shields. The boss laughed.
Go ahead, son. Get a taste!
He held his arms out to the side, shotgun dangling loosely from his right hand. Ethan took aim at him. His hand was shaking so badly that he had to steady it with his other hand. He braced himself and pulled the trigger. Click.
You got a pair after all, the boss mused. You really think I'd be stupid enough to hand you back your gun without taking all the bullets first?
Ethan struggled to release the clip. He knew how to shoot a gun, but he was less familiar with the moving parts. When he found the release button, the clip slid out, empty. The third man came and took the gun out of Ethan's hand. With a zip tie, he secured Ethan's wrist together behind his back. The second man tied Aaron, who sat there numbly staring at his brother.
Stand up,
he ordered gruffly, prodding Aaron in the back with his boot.
James,
the boss spoke,
take those two over that way.
He gestured towards the trees vaguely with the shotgun.
David, take this one.
He nodded at Aaron. The man named James shoved Sam and Jacob hard and marched them into the woods, poking at their backs occasionally with his knife. David spat again, took Aaron by the arm, and led him off in a different direction. Ethan was soon left alone with the boss.
He couldn't bring himself to look at Tommy without a wave of nausea twisting his gut.
You, come with me.
The boss approached Ethan and pushed him down the footpath toward the lake. As they got farther away from their campsite, the light from the fire faded. Somewhere nearby, he could hear one of the men, James, telling Sam and Jacob to sit down and hold still. The boss put a hand on Ethan's shoulder, bringing him to a halt when they heard the sounds of a struggle. A man cried out in pain. Someone was clumsily crashing through the woods.
Run, Jacob! Get help!
Sam's voice cried out. They listened as Jacob fell to the ground, grunting loudly. And then he screamed. Ethan cringed when he heard the repeated sound that a knife makes when it cuts into a slab of meat. Jacob's screams became distorted. His voice sounded strangled, and his cries gurgled before he went quiet. Ethan bent over and retched as he pictured what was happening to his best friend.
Everything under control, James,
the boss called out.
Motherfucker bit me,
James answered angrily. The boss chuckled softly and squatted down next to Ethan.
Why are you doing this to us?
Ethan said, after spitting out the residual bile in his mouth. The boss grabbed him by his shirt and dragged him to the nearest tree. Ethan kicked at him as hard as he could. His left foot contacted the man's knee, causing him to go down. With his arms still tied behind his back, Ethan struggled to his feet. He kicked at the man's head, but the boss caught his leg as he came in for the second kick and stood abruptly, holding Ethan's leg tight to his torso. This caused Ethan to lose his balance and land hard on his back. Searing pain ripped through his right arm as Ethan landed, and he heard a loud snap. He cried out, but was silenced when the boss put all his weight on his knee, straight into Ethan's gut. He punched Ethan in the face, hard. The force of the impact between the man's fist and the hard-packed earth made his head spin. He hit him again, two, three times, until Ethan was barely conscious. Blood spattered his nose and mouth, and he blinked, disoriented. The boss slung his limp body against the base of a nearby tree and tied him to it with a thick rope he pulled off his utility belt. The last thing Ethan saw was the man walking away into the darkness. When Mark and Julie finally pulled into the office parking lot, it was empty. They ran up the two steps and tried the office door, but of course, it was locked. Julie pounded on the door regardless. Office hours are 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., Mark said despairingly. He looked at his watch and saw it was well past midnight. They each tried their cell phones in vain. Mark banged the doorframe a few more times. Around the side of the office, Julie found an old payphone. It looked ancient, probably hadn't been used in years, but she picked the phone up and dialed 911.
Hello? Yes, I'd like to report a...
She trailed off, trying to describe the situation.
We're at the Blue Ridge Lake Reservation. We think we heard a gunshot and some screaming. Can you please send someone out here to check it out?
She paused as she listened.
I see. Please, tell them to hurry.
She hung up. Mark appeared at the edge of the office's front porch.
Did you get the police?
She nodded.
The dispatcher said it might take up to 2 hours for someone to get out here. She told us to wait here, at the office.
They walked around to the front steps and sat. After a moment, Mark spoke.
We're really just going to sit here and wait for him? People might need immediate help.
He trailed off as they heard footsteps approaching from within the office. A light went on, and Henry, the old man who had checked them in, appeared at the door.
What's going on?
He asked as he stepped out onto the porch, pulling on a worn denim jacket. Mark and Julie told him what they had heard. He thought for a moment, his bushy eyebrows furrowing.
I think I might have an idea who it is. We've been having some issues with poaching on the reservation the past few years.
Henry disappeared back into the office briefly, before re-emerging, holding an old revolver pistol and a .38 special.
Do you know how to handle a gun?
He was speaking to Mark.
Me? No, not really.
Mark chuckled nervously.
I'm an emergency responder. I usually just patch the holes these things make.
I can shoot,
Julie said, speaking up. Henry turned and looked at her with surprise, then nodded. He handed her the .38 caliber and said,
We'll take my truck. It's around back.
What about the police?
Mark asked. They told us to wait here for them. The old man shook his head.
I'm willing to bet they'll take their sweet time getting here. Unless somebody finds and reports an actual body, they just assume it's likely to be a waste of their time driving all the way out into the mountains. It usually is. Kids go missing, parents panic and call the cops. 9 times out of 10, the kid shows up before they even get here. This park, unfortunately, has a history of crying wolf to them, so to speak.
When Ethan woke up, the first thing he felt was his right arm throbbing. How long had he been unconscious? In the distance, he could see that their fire had long gone out. It was just barely getting light. His body was stiff and numb, and the chill in the air made it worse. He pulled against the rope, but it was tied tight, and the pain in his arm forced him to stop. Panting from his effort and sheer panic, Ethan did the only thing he could do.
Help! Somebody help! Please! Somebody help me!
He screamed. Ethan heard footsteps crunching toward him and screamed louder, but his heart sank to his stomach when he saw the three men who appeared before him.
Finally awake, I see.
The boss sneered at him. His shotgun was missing.
Your other friends kept us company while you were out.
David and James both chuckled at this, and Ethan noticed with horror that they all had dark bloodstains on their clothing.
Untie him and let him see our handiwork.
James cut through the rope with his knife, which had dried blood on the blade, while David held on to Ethan. They yanked him to his feet, cut the zip tie holding his hands, and shoved him in the direction they wanted him to go. He thought about running, but his body was still so stiff and sore from being tied down to that tree, he knew he wouldn't make it far. He cradled his injured arm to his chest, his mind racing through all the possibilities and outcomes. None looked good for him. Ahead of him, he could see a form on the ground. He knew it was Jacob before he got close enough to see. Jacob was lying on his back in the dirt, with his hands still tied behind him. His skin had turned a pale, waxy yellow, and his face was twisted into a horrific sneer. His chest and stomach were covered in stab wounds, some gouging deep enough to spill some of his intestines out the side. His eyes seemed to follow Ethan and the men as they pushed him further along. The path opened up to a small clearing, and Ethan wished he hadn't looked. He saw Sam, sprawled on his stomach in the dirt and pine needles. He still had a rope twisted around his neck, used as both murder weapon and harness. His eyes bulged, and it looked like he had bitten halfway through his tongue during the struggle. Empty beer cans from the boys' cooler were scattered around the clearing, making Ethan wonder how long Sam and Aaron were tortured like this. He looked away before he got sick again, his empty stomach threatening to upheave again. He could see the lake through the trees. The surface of the water was sparkling as the sky grew lighter.
"Put up a good fight, that one,"
James said, his voice filled with sickening glee.
"Sure did," agreed David. "Reminded me of that dog we got when we were teenagers back in Jackson. You remember that?"
James laughed.
"Aroo! Aroo!"
He howled, and David laughed, making Ethan sick to his stomach. He turned away from the sight, only to see Aaron staring up at him with glassy eyes. He was slumped over the trunk of a tree that had fallen. His face was barely recognizable. He was beaten so badly. Several of his teeth littered the forest floor before him. Then Ethan saw the shotgun resting against the trunk behind him. A hole had been torn through Aaron's torso, nearly cutting him in half.
"Let's get this finished up. It's getting late,"
the boss said in a tone that sent chills through Ethan. "They've done this before." In the growing light, Ethan could see now that he must be James and David's father. The two men were still guffawing and carrying on when the boss whistled sharply. They fell silent. In the distance, they could hear a diesel engine crunching through the overgrown trail. They could see nothing, but they heard a car door slam.
"Hello?"
a woman's voice called out, followed by a man's. Someone was looking for them. David walked back to the trunk to stand by his father, leaving James, the smaller man, by Ethan's side. All of them were distracted by whoever was searching through the woods. Ethan's heart raced. This could be his only chance.
Adrenaline coursed through his body, giving him newfound energy. Without thinking, he lurched forward and buried his shoulder into James's side. Grabbing the shotgun off the trunk, he took off through the trees. He heard James swear, but he didn't turn to see if he was being chased. He was headed toward the water. It was the opposite direction of the people in the truck, but he couldn't risk trying to get past the other two men. He crashed through the woods, small branches slapping at his face and legs as he ran. At the water's edge, he didn't hesitate and plunged straight in. The water was freezing. It took his breath right out of him. He could hear the men in pursuit close behind him. He let the shotgun sink, as he now needed his good arm to do most of the work that the other couldn't. The cold water made it difficult for him to move, but he swam at least 20 yards before he turned around to see if they were following him into the water. The three men stood at the shoreline. The boss loaded a new clip into Ethan's father's gun. He aimed at Ethan's head, bobbing above the water. Ethan ducked down below the water and tried to put more distance between them, but he couldn't stay under for long. He resurfaced, gasping for air that the icy water seemed to suck out of him. The boss took aim once more and fired. Ethan flinched as he heard the shot ring out, but the water around him remained undisturbed. The boss took another shot. Nothing. Ethan watched as he removed the clip from the gun angrily.
"Blanks!"
the boss swore. Ethan remembered his father on their camping trips. "Bears and other animals will run away if they hear the gunshot. You don't need to actually shoot them. It's safer that way if you're going to have a loaded gun lying around with little boys like you," his father explained to him once. It felt like forever ago. "But," he added, "just in case, I always leave a few live rounds at the bottom of the clip, in case the blanks don't do the trick." Ethan's relief soon vanished as he watched the boss empty the clip into his hand. He found the real bullets at the bottom. Ethan was struggling to keep his head above the water. His entire body was numb. He closed his eyes as the boss took aim once more.
Bam!
There was no mistake in the difference in sound. But he missed, the bullet hitting the water only a foot away from his head. The boss took a knee to steady his aim, and Ethan could practically feel the gun lining up directly with him. "This is it," he thought, closing his eyes once more as his limbs gave out. "If he doesn't get me, I'll drown anyway."
Bam!
Ethan opened his eyes in shock to see the boss slumped forward, face down in the shallow water. James and David had their backs to him, arms raised. He could see someone coming down the path to the lake, a woman with blonde hair. She was holding a small pistol. The old man from the park office followed close behind her, gun drawn. He looked 10 years younger than when he had checked them in. A third man came with them. He saw Ethan's head barely staying afloat and ran past David and James, who were now on their knees. Ethan tried to swim back to shore, but the cold was shutting his body down, sapping all of his remaining energy. He dipped under. He barely noticed when the man reached him and hauled him back to dry land. Mark dragged the limp body of the boy out of the water and pumped his chest a few times. He could see that his arm was broken, but otherwise he seemed relatively unharmed compared to the others he saw in the woods. He pumped the boy's chest again and was prepared to perform CPR when the boy heaved and spat out a mouthful of water.
"Good boy, good boy. Get it all out,"
Mark said encouragingly, turning him to his side. Behind him, Julie kept her gun aimed at the two men while Henry tied their hands behind them with the ropes they had found. The boy stopped coughing up water, but sobbed, curled on his side. "It's going to be okay. You're safe now," Mark spoke softly, rubbing the boy's back. "Let's get you out of these clothes and dried off." When they returned to the park office, they found two state troopers milling about near their patrol car. Once they spoke with Henry, they immediately radioed for an ambulance and backup. The parking lot was soon filled with flashing lights and local police. David and James were arrested and taken away. A detective came and spoke with Ethan to get his statement as a paramedic splinted his arm. Mark and Julie stood by his side, listening in horror.
As he finished telling the story, his parents pulled into the parking lot, along with Jacob's parents. Sam's father showed up behind them with Aaron and Tommy's parents in his truck. His mother burst into tears the second she saw him and ran to hug him.
"Ethan, are you okay? What happened? Where are the others?"
Her voice was tight with concern. He started to retell what had happened, but broke down when he saw the other parents realize that their sons were not there.
"Shh, honey, it's okay."
She held him to her chest, rocking him gently. They watched together as the medics pushed carts carrying his friends in zipped body bags. Ethan would never forget the sound of the twins' mother shrieking when she pushed past them, insisting on seeing her sons. Their father had to catch her and turn her away, her screams echoing through the park. Jacob's parents sat together quietly, mourning their only son. Sam's father was talking to some officers, his voice rising in anger, unable to accept what they were telling him.
"Dad,"
Ethan spoke finally,
"those blank bullets in the gun, they saved my life."
His father looked at him confused.
"He tried to shoot me when I was in the water."
Ethan's father said nothing, but hugged him and his mother with tears in his eyes. Ethan and his parents also hugged and thanked Julie, Mark, and Henry for their heroism. Then, they rode in silence to the hospital, where Ethan's arm was put in a cast. The detective who took his statement at the park office approached them.
"Those two men are going to be locked away for good, with their records. It's over now. We found their camp not far from where you and your friends were staying. Their father was a wanted man in a few nearby states. Looks like they were hiding out there for quite some time."
He spoke softly, carefully choosing his words. Ethan said nothing and looked away, thinking of his friends. The detective put a hand on his shoulder.
"It'll take time, but you survived this. You will get through this."
He offered several pamphlets to Ethan's parents about PTSD therapy and treatment. Ethan just wanted to shut the world out. He wanted to go home and curl up under the blankets on his bed and stay there for eternity. He survived, but he doubted he would ever live again. You've just heard Trust by Dana Norris. Dana Norris was born in rural Pennsylvania and quickly found a love of horror. In Philadelphia, she studied film for 2 years at Temple University, writing screenplays for horror movies in her free time before switching majors. She graduated in 2015 with a degree in strategic communication and moved to North Carolina, where she currently resides. Her first book, Lingering Things and Other Dark Tales, is the first in a series of 3 horror anthologies. Dana draws inspiration from true crime documentaries, long walks in the woods with her dog, and things that go bump in the night. You can find more of her work at Velux Books. And that, friends, closes out tonight's episode. I'd like to mention that the version of Trust you just heard was edited slightly, with the author's permission, to remove a few particularly gruesome aspects. The story's based on the real-life Gitche Manitou murders of 1973, and while I tried to present everything on this show as intended by the author, I decided it was a bit too soon after our last episode featuring atrocious acts against children. In this case, the details of the murders are readily available for anyone wishing to look into them further. In any event, I'd like to thank Dana Norris for the stories tonight, and also all of you for tuning in. Next week brings a brand new episode of Horror Hill, so be sure to tune back in then. Until that time, my friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production.
Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.